I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is our fourth lecture on Plato's Gorgias. And this is the second of three lectures on Socrates' conversation with Callicles. So where did we leave off last time? We left off with Socrates discussing with Callicles the importance of self-control. Callicles was arguing that the best life is basically having the biggest desires you could possibly have and satisfying them. And that means no self-control. He thinks that controlling one's appetites, controlling one's desires, is the sort of thing that a loser would think of doing. But the winners in life, they don't have to do that. And the best life really is to have as much as you can, grab off as much as you can, get as much as you can, get more than your fair share, or better yet, to recognize that the fair share is whatever the strongest can get. And Socrates says, well, what about ruling oneself? You rule over others, you grab off as much as you can for yourself. What about ruling over yourself? And Callicles says, that's absurd. A man can't be happy if he's enslaved to anybody at all, including himself. And therefore, the life of happiness, the good life, is the life of endless appetites and being able to satisfy them. Having endless appetites and the power to satisfy them is the good life for Callicles. And then at a certain point, it becomes clear that what Callicles is doing is defining the good life as the life of pleasure, the life of satisfying one's desires. And so Socrates goes forward with a series of arguments to criticize the idea that pleasure is the good. The Greek word for pleasure is hedone, and the idea that the good life is a life of pleasure is called hedonism. We know about this in basic ethics classes. We know about this in advertising, although I don't think advertising uses big words like that anymore, but maybe in the past they would try and sell you on certain hedonistic pleasures. Our whole economy is an economy of hedonism. So I think that it's extremely important to understand why the life of hedonism, the life of pleasure, is not the best life. Because many people are selling that very idea today, that the best life is the life of pleasure, getting as much as you can, and that you're losers if you exercise self-control. You're losers if you don't have as much pleasure as you possibly can. So let's look at these arguments. There's a whole bunch of back and forth. These arguments are minced up into tiny little back and forth exchanges, and it's a bit hard to follow. I'm certainly not going to lay them out by reading it. I want to lay it out in a more schematic way. And so I've created this little chart. These are the first four arguments against hedonism and the Gorgias that Socrates gives to Callicles. The first argument has two premises: the good, happiness, and the bad, wretchedness, cannot exist in the same person at the same time and in the same respect. You cannot be happy and unhappy at the same time and in the same respect. You could be happy that you're listening to a beautiful piece of music. You could be sad that you stepped in a rain puddle on your way to the symphony, but you would be happy and unhappy at the same time, but not in the same respect. On the one hand, you're happy, and on the other hand, you're not happy. That's not to say that you are unhappy at the same time and in the same respect. The second premise is pleasure, which is associated with satisfaction, and pain, which is associated with desire, can exist in the same person at the same time. Now, what does this mean? Well, the example that one could give is that if you are thirsty, that's a form of desire, and that's a form of pain. And if you begin drinking, you experience the pleasure of satisfying the desire while at the same time feeling the pang of the desire. So you can experience pleasure and pain at the same time and even in the same respect. Because the process of fulfilling a desire involves a kind of mixture of pleasure and pain at the same time. So pleasure and pain can exist at the same time and in the same respect, but happiness and wretchedness cannot exist at the same time and in the same respect. Therefore, the good, happiness, is not pleasure, and the bad, wretchedness, is not pain. Happiness is different from pleasure because they have different modes of existence. You could put it that way. Happiness and wretchedness cannot exist in the same person at the same time in the same respect, whereas pleasure and pain can. Since these are two different modes of existence, these cannot be the same thing. The good, the happiness cannot be the same as pleasure, and the bad, wretchedness cannot be the same as pain. Now, the second argument begins with the premise, the good and the bad do not cease together. The ceasing of the good is the bad. The ceasing of the bad is the good. They don't end at the same time. When one ends, the other begins. Second premise, pleasure and pain cease at the same time. So when you eat and you become full, the pleasure of eating ceases at the same time as the pain of hunger ceases. There comes a point where you're hungry and you're eating, and then you get full, and suddenly the food becomes repulsive to you. You don't want to eat another bite. So he's saying, again, that these have different modes of existence. Good and bad not only don't exist at the same time and in the same respect, they succeed one another. The good gives way to the bad gives way to the good. Whereas pleasure and pain can exist at the same time, therefore, the good is not pleasure and the bad is not pain. Again, they have different modes of being, so they cannot be the same things. The third argument is pure Platonism in its first two premises. Good men are good because of the presence of goodness. Bad men are bad because of the presence of badness. This good guy has something good about him, basically. It's not a terribly controversial claim. These bad things, they have something that we just don't like. Some bad quality. Some bad quality makes this bad. Some form of badness makes this fruit rotten. Some form of badness makes this person rot. Now, the third premise is that good and bad men both experience pleasure and pain. And you can sort of tease out what he's meaning with these two further premises. Good men remain good while experiencing pain. Bad men remain bad while experiencing pleasure. Therefore, pleasure cannot be the cause of goodness, and pain can't be the cause of badness. Therefore, pleasure is not the good, pain is not the bad. What's going on here? He's saying that we recognize that there are men who are good. Okay, if good men are good because of the presence of goodness, then wouldn't they become bad if they suffer pain? Which is what the hedonist would predict, right? If hedonism is correct, then when you suffer pain, you become a bad man. Good men don't become bad men necessarily when they suffer pain. Therefore, pleasure cannot be the good. It's the same is true with bad men. If pleasure is the good, then wouldn't you be able to make a bad man into a good man simply by making him enjoy some pleasurable things? You know, a nice massage, a good meal, You know, all the wonderful things that Hunter Biden could afford to revel in through the corruption provided by his father. Hunter Biden is a guy who had a lot of pleasures: crack cocaine, hoes, expensive meals, glitzy resorts, things like that. Wouldn't this make Hunter a good man if pleasure is the good? Aren't the Tate brothers good men? After all, they've had plenty of money and probably lots of drugs and certainly lots of hoes. That's what they made their living from. They were pimps. These guys had a lot of pleasure. Therefore, if hedonism is true, these would be good men. And that just doesn't follow. We all know better, right? And Socrates is, I think, making a very valid argument here. Now, after the third argument, Callicles slips up by making a distinction between good kinds of pleasure and bad kinds of pleasure. And Socrates has him at that point because, and this is the fourth argument, if pleasure is the good and pain is the bad, there can be no bad pleasures or good pains. There are bad pleasures and good pains. For instance, well, there are bad pleasures like getting hooked on crack. And there are good pains like going through withdrawal or like getting necessary surgery done to save one's life. There are bad pleasures and good pains. Therefore, the good is not pleasure and the bad is not pain. It's a very simple argument. It's a very valid argument. You can do this with any proposed idea of the good life. For instance, some people say that self-actualization is the good life. Well, can you think of examples where self-actualization might not be a good thing? Jeffrey Dahmer, for instance. Jeffrey Dahmer actualized the potential to be a cannibal. Lazy people actualize their potentiality for laziness. So Aristotle, who deals with this, says, well, look, self-actualization alone isn't enough because there can be good self-actualization and bad self-actualization. Therefore, there's got to be something more to the good life than self-actualization. And so what he says is that the good life is self-actualization of the good sort. Well, what that means is that the good is something over and above self-actualization. And we still haven't defined it yet. But we know it's not self-actualization. And you can make the same argument with the idea that the good life is a life of pleasure. As soon as you recognize there are good pleasures and bad pleasures, and we can all see that that's true, then we are in the position to say, all right, the good life isn't pleasure. There's something over and above pleasure that's the good life. We haven't defined it yet, but we know enough to know that these attempts to define it as pleasure or self-actualization are inadequate. Now, the good life might include pleasure. It might include self-actualization, but it can only include the good kinds. And that depends on knowledge of the good, and therefore we have to continue further in defining what the good is. But we know it's not pleasure. It's a very powerful argument. And Callicles is really defeated at this point. And so I'd like to look in the text a bit. I'd like to look at the framing of these four arguments. At 494D, 494C, Socrates says, well, if pleasure is the good life, then if a guy just spends his time scratching his itches, right? Scratching his whole life long, is that a good life? And Callicles is annoyed at this. Callicles says, I say that even the man who scratches would have a pleasant life. And if a pleasant one, a happy one too, adds Socrates. And Callicles says, yes. So the pleasant life, the life of pleasure, is the good life, that happiness. And Socrates says, what if he scratches only his head? And isn't the climax of this sort of thing the life of a catamite, which is a male prostitute, a frightfully shameful and miserable one? Or will you have the nerve to say that they are happy as long as they have what they need to their heart's content? And Callicles suddenly snaps back, aren't you ashamed, Socrates, to bring our discussion to such matters? Callicles is the one who claimed that he was untrammeled by any considerations of shame and could talk about everything. And now suddenly Callicles is shaming Socrates for talking about something that he thinks is shameful, which is the life of a prostitute. And Socrates says, is it I who bring them there, my splendid fellow? Or is it the man who claims, just like that, that those who enjoy themselves, however they may be doing it, are happy and doesn't discriminate between good kinds of pleasure and bad? Tell me now, too, whether you say that the pleasant and the good are the same, or whether there is some pleasure that isn't good. And Callicles says, okay, well, I say that pleasure and the good are the same. And then he goes into the four arguments, the first three arguments. And after the third argument, he wrings out of Callicles the admission that there are good pleasures and bad pleasures. And so this is at 499b. Callicles says, I've been listening to you for some time now, Socrates, and agreeing with you, while thinking that even if a person grants some point to you in jest, you gladly fasten on it the way boys do, as though you really think I or anybody else at all don't believe that some pleasures are better and others worse. Socrates responds, oh, Callicles, what a rascal you are. You treat me like a child. But he's sprung the trap because then he can show that if there are good and bad pleasures, then pleasure cannot be the standard of what's good. There's a higher standard that divides pleasure up into the good and the bad. And so at this point, we start getting into a very, I think, eloquent and somewhat densely stated treatise on Socratic ethics. And it's quite powerful. It becomes less dialogical and more speech-like. There's a point where Socrates carries on the dialogue himself because Callicles won't answer. And then at a certain point, when he just stops pretending to have a dialogue, he just starts speechifying. And it's really quite powerful. Okay. So we're at a little above 500 in the margin. And Socrates says, well, let's talk about priorities here, Callicles. Let's talk about priorities here. You've admitted that there's a distinction between the good and pleasure, because some pleasures are good, some are bad. So let's talk about priorities. What's more important, the good or the pleasant? And obviously, if pleasures are not always good, then they have less importance than the good itself. And the only importance they might have is if they can be subordinated to the good. And so he basically says, look, what's most rational? To pursue happiness for the sake of pleasure, the good life for the sake of pleasure, or to use pleasure for the sake of the good life. Obviously, pursuing the good is more important than pleasure. And then he raises the question at 500a, now, is it for every man to pick out which kinds of pleasures are good ones and which are bad ones? Or does this require a craftsman in each case? Basically, he's talking here about art or techne again. So somebody with technical knowledge. Is it for each man to decide what what's a good pleasure or a bad pleasure, or is there an expert in goodness? And Callicles says, well, it requires an expert. Let's recall what I was actually saying to Polus and Gorgias. I was saying, if you remember, that there are some practices that concern themselves with nothing further than pleasure and procure only pleasure. Practices that are ignorant about what's better and worse. While there are other practices that do know what's good and what's bad. And I place the knack, not the craft of pastry baking, among those that are concerned with pleasure, and the medical craft or art among those concerned with what's good. And by Zeus, the god of friendship, Callicles, please don't think that you should jest with me either or answer anything that comes to mind contrary to what you really think. And please don't accept what you get from me as though I'm jesting. For you see, don't you, that our discussions about this and what even a man of little intelligence, and what would even a man of little intelligence take more seriously than this? What is this? He answers, about the way we're supposed to live. It's no joking matter to talk about what the good life is for man, he's saying. We're not playing children's games anymore. Don't joke around with me and don't think that I'm joking here. This is deadly serious. We're talking about the good man, the good life for man. And then he says, to be more specific, is it the good life the way you urge me toward, to engage in these manly activities, to make speeches among the people, to practice oratory, and to be active in the sort of politics you people engage in these days? Or is it the life spent in philosophy? And in what way does this latter way of life differ from the former? So let's take a step back here and we'll look at the chart that I created when we did the discussion about the difference between oratory and the true political science. So let's just look at that slide. Okay. This is the chart. So if we want to review this quickly, this is from the discussion between Socrates and Polus. He's talking about the soul and the body. These are the two objects of action. And the soul and the body can have two different states. And these are the states of well-being, which is real fitness, and the state of merely feeling good, apparent fitness. Well-being, real fitness, is produced by friendship, by edification, which builds people up. It's aided by techne, which is skill plus logic or knowledge, and it's guided by the good, knowledge of the good. Feeling good or apparent fitness is produced by flattery, he says, by pandering, by stooping down. Basically, it's by taking people as they are with their preferences as they're given and pleasing them as they are. And to do that, you've got to stoop down. Now, you can be aided by a knack, as he calls it. It's a skill without logos. It's guesswork, schmoozing, puffery, bravado. It's the stuff that you see from people who are really good at pandering, especially pandering to people's vices. And what is this whole process guided by? It's guided by the pleasurable. You're trying to gratify people. You're trying to exploit people by tickling their fancies as their fancies exist at any given time. Okay. So these two processes can be worked on the soul and the body. And so there are four categories here. There are four squares here. The well-being, the real fitness of the soul, is produced by politics, he says. And that includes legislation and punishment, things that build up spiritual health and things that restore spiritual health or purge spiritual sickness. Counterfeit politics, which is the form of politics that exists everywhere, basically, is about corrupting the soul. It consists in sophistry and oratory, and it works by basically, again, pandering to people's vices and follies, whatever level of development they're at the current time. It finds a message to please people like that. And by pleasing them, by gratifying them, it gains power from them. So politicians harvest power from the people by pandering to their vices and follies. And then they do what they like with the power. And of course, Callicles makes it clear that what they like to do is get a whole bunch of society's goods and enjoy themselves, live it up as much as possible. So that's the background here, just to remind you of what they're talking about. And now the contrast, though, is between the life of politics in the counterfeit sense, described by Callicles as going out and orating, taking part in politics, and getting as much as you can, versus a life of philosophy. It's not true politics now that's the counterpart here, it's philosophy. And that's interesting. That's an interesting modulation. But let's be clear about what true politics is. True politics, again, is edifying politics that's aided by knowledge of the good. It is therefore philosophical politics, because what is wisdom? Wisdom is the ability to make right use of all things. Wisdom is knowing the good and being able to apply it. And so there's an alliance here, an implicit alliance between philosophy and true politics. So that's something to be borne in mind. And of course we know, because famously Plato was the advocate of the idea that troubles will never cease until philosophers become kings or kings become philosophers. Namely that wisdom and political power need to be somehow fused together. And we're seeing that necessary fusion intimated here, both in the early scheme that I've laid out in this chart, and now here, where the place of true politics is occupied now by the philosopher himself, Socrates. And so he says, perhaps it's best to distinguish these two lives, as I've tried to do. Having done that, and having agreed that these are two distinct lives, it's best to examine how they differ from each other, and which of them is the one we should live. Now, perhaps you don't yet know what I'm talking about. And Callicles says, no, I certainly don't. Well, I'll tell you more clearly. Given that we've agreed, you and I, that there is such a thing as good and such a thing as pleasant, and that the pleasant is different from the good, and there's a practice of each of them and a procedure for obtaining it, the quest for the pleasant on the one hand and that for the good on the other, give me first your assent on this point or withhold it. Do you assent to it? Okay, so there's a quest for pleasure and a quest for the good. And that aligns with this distinction in the chart between the pursuit of well-being and the pursuit of feeling good. And of course, the pursuit of well-being is aligned with philosophy and true politics. The pursuit of feeling good is aligned with counterfeit politics and the arts produced or taught by the sophists. The sophists were more than just rhetoricians. They taught a political science, a counterfeit political science, if you will, a political science of aggrandizing oneself by battening onto people's vices. Now, this isn't just applicable to politics, right? It's applicable to entertainment. It's applicable to economics. Any product that people sell that enriches them by pandering to people's ignorance and vice is an example of this process of corruption. Basically, market capitalism today is an example of this, because it's just true that you make more money pandering to people's bad taste than you do by trying to elevate their taste. It's just the truth. And if the only culture that people have access to is basically commercialized popular culture, then what you would expect is people's taste to become ever cruder and more debased, because there's no force out there to raise them up, to edify them. Now, we used to have institutions like religion and education to try and edify people, to try and make them mature, to try and refine them. But those have been recast as consumer-type institutions too. We have freedom of religion. What is freedom of religion? Well, it allows you to shop around for the best deal. What's the best deal? Well, for most people, it's what satisfies them. It's what flatters them. It's what makes them comfortable with who they are. Doesn't try and raise them up. Rather, it tells them, Jesus loves you just the way you are, and you can be saved by having an emotional outburst and running to the front of the church just once, right? That's more popular. It sells more than more rigorous religions that would say, no, you've got a lot of work to do, and it may never be enough. Which is going to be more popular? Obviously, the sloppy, emotional kind of stuff that people go in for today in these mega churches, the spiritual people, the spiritual but not religious people, the people who basically are shoppers for crystals and essential oils and things like that. I don't deny that there's some little spark that they're trying to tend there, but the very consumer circus nature of how religion is experienced in our society means that chances are they're going to settle for something that's vulgarizing and pandering and that helps them feel good about themselves without actually improving them, spiritually speaking. Think about education. You can shop around in education, and there's a terrible downward pull, not just because we have to pretend that all people are equal now, although there's a lot of that going on, and that's probably the main thing that's bastardized education in America, but there's also just the desire to make people feel good about themselves just the way they are. After all, having rigorous standards is bad for some people's self-esteem. So there are all kinds of motives that conspire together in modern society to undermine even institutions that are supposed to edify us. And the main thing that does that is just the pervasiveness of the market model. If you can shop around for salvation, people are going to buy the easy stuff rather than the hard stuff. Now, there are some people who seek out the hard stuff. There's some people who are like that. There's some people who seek out high culture and are bound and determined to edify themselves. But they would do that under any circumstances anyway. And the purpose of a good society, though, a well-ordered society, is to help the people who can't do that on their own. The people who can't pursue virtue and edification on their own. The people who need to be nudged toward it. Those institutions that nudge us away from vice and vulgarity are being deconstructed relentlessly and being replaced with consumerist model institutions that basically dispense pabulum. Okay. So this isn't just politics, it's economics, it's all of society. All of society can be divided into institutions and practices and people who are concerned with well-being, spiritual edification, and people who are concerned with simply getting more for themselves by pandering to people's vices. Or if the market is clearing and you need to open up new markets, one way to do that is to lower people's standards still further. After all, there are all kinds of residual standards about what's appropriate. Leftover hang-ups from religion and old high culture, things like that, that make some people cringe in embarrassment at the thought of engaging in certain things, looking at certain things. Well, if you can wear those inhibitions away, you can open up new markets. And so not only does capitalism pander to people as they are, but it has an incentive to corrupt them, to expand the market, so that there are things that were once considered obscene that now people want to see. Obscenity literally just means the things that shouldn't be seen. And now people want to see obscenity a whole lot, and people make billions and billions of dollars just from peddling smut. So around 501, Socrates basically lays out the essential analogy that he uses throughout his ethical theory between the body and the soul. Medicine is the art of improving the body, purging its illnesses. Physical training is also involved. So let's look at this chart again. Health production and restoration boils down to gymnastics, personal training, whatever, and medicine. What's the analogy with the soul then? Well, there's something that produces health in the soul and purges sickness. He describes this as true legislation and true justice. Just above 501, Socrates says, "Come then and agree further with me about what I was saying to them too, if you think that what I said then was true. I wasn't saying, wasn't I, that I didn't think that pastry baking is a craft, but a knack, whereas medicine is a craft, an art. I said that the one, medicine, has investigated both the nature of the object it serves and the cause of the things it does, and is able to give an account of each of these. The other, the one concerned with pleasure, to which the whole of its service is entirely devoted, proceeds towards its object in a quite uncraft-like way, without having at all considered either the nature of pleasure or its cause. It does so completely irrationally, with virtually no discrimination. Through routine and knack, it merely preserves the memory of what customarily happens, and that's how it also supplies its pleasures. So consider first of all whether you think that this account is an adequate one, and whether you think that there are also other similar preoccupations in the case of the soul. Do you think that some of the latter are of the order of crafts and possess forethought about what's best for the soul, while others slight this and have investigated only, as in the other case, the soul's way of getting its pleasure, without considering which of the pleasures is better or worse, and without having any concerns about anything but mere gratification, whether for the better or for the worse?" So he's laying out the distinction here between true politics and counterfeit politics. Again, he's revisiting this chart. So far, so good. So let's pause here, though, for a second. Let's just raise a possibility here. It's not a possibility, it's now a reality. What if there wasn't just a knack of counterfeit politics and a knack of counterfeit health? What if these things have become sciences of their own? They have. The people who make billions from the corruption of your tastes and the exploitation of your ignorance, they're not just futzing like they were 2,400 years ago, 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece. They're not just fumbling. They're not just empirics and quacks. These people have got it down to a science. They have it dialed in. There is a science of spiritual corruption and a science of physical corruption. We have a food industry that creates crap, basically, but highly palatable, even addictive crap. And of course, let's not talk about food. Let's just talk about the addictive stuff out there, the actual addictive drugs. We don't just have pastry bakers out there. We have meth labs out there. We have people refining every possible form of slavery to pleasure. It's gotten far, far worse since Socrates' time, is what I'm saying. It is not just a contest between true politics and true care of the body versus the fumbling, bumbling empirics and quacks who want to corrupt us and exploit us. It is now a contest between two sciences. Their science is massively subsidized by the industries that it makes billions for. So we are up against the science of spiritual corruption and the science of physical corruption, entire industries founded upon these sciences and devoted to exploiting them to the absolute maximum. And what is arrayed against them? What sort of institutions do we have that edify? What sort of institutions do we have that improve people's bodies? Well, fortunately, there are health fanatics out there. Fortunately, we're doing pretty well with the gyms and the good diets and stuff like that. Less so in the spiritual realm and the political realm. And that's why we live in a society where the further you look into the future, the further the line goes down, the moral line goes down. The decline is baked in for quite a long time into the future. So let's go back to the text. Let's go back to a happier time when it was science against the fumbling, bumbling advocates of corruption. Socrates says, well, you know, if there's an art of pandering to individual souls and bodies, isn't there possibly an art of pandering to them in groups? And Callicles agrees with that. Yes. And then Socrates talks about entertainment. He talks about lyre playing, training choruses, dithyrambs, and so forth, singing. At 502b, he says, and what about that majestic, awe-inspiring practice, the composition of tragedy? What is it after? Is the project, the intent of tragic composition merely the gratification of spectators, as you think, or does it also strive valiantly not to say anything that is corrupt, though it may be pleasant and gratifying to them, and to utter in both speech and song anything that might be unpleasant but beneficial, whether the spectators enjoy it or not? In which of these ways do you think tragedy is being composed? And Callicles says, this much is obvious, Socrates, that it's more bent upon giving pleasure and upon gratifying the spectators. Entertainment then is like entertainment now, although Greek tragedy is on a far higher level than any of the stuff that we get today, and still Plato looked upon it as pandering and corrupting. If only we had the corpus of ancient Greek tragedy rather than just fragments of it, and if only our popular culture were that quote-unquote corrupt, we'd be so much better off. And so Socrates says, well, when you strip away the song and the dance, basically, from tragedy, what's left but speeches? And Callicles says, right, speeches given to a large gathering. That's right. And he says, so poetry is a kind of popular harangue. And such popular harangue would be oratory then. Don't poets practice oratory in the theaters? And Callicles says, yes, he agrees. And then Socrates transitions to the question about oratory itself. Very well. What about the oratory addressed to the Athenian people and to those in other cities composed of free men? What is our view of this kind? Do you think that orators always speak with regard to what's best? Do they always set their sights on making the citizens as good as possible through their speeches? Or are they also bent upon the gratification of the citizens? And do they slight the common good for the sake of their own private good, and so keep company with the people trying solely to gratify them without any thought at all for whether this will make them better or worse? And Callicles says, and he gets thoughtful here. This is interesting. The issue you're asking about isn't just a simple one, for there are those who say what they do because they do care about the citizens, and there are also those like the ones you're talking about. This is interesting. Callicles actually defends some of the politicians. And that might indicate that his own political ambitions are not entirely of the dishonorable kind. So we'll keep reading. Socrates says, that's good enough, for this matter really has two parts to it. Then one part of it would be flattery, I suppose, and shameful public harangue, while the other, that of getting the souls of the citizens to be as good as possible and of striving valiantly to say what is best, whether the audience will find it more pleasant or more unpleasant, is something admirable. But you've never seen this type of oratory, or if you can mention any orator of this type, why haven't you let me also know who he is? And Callicles says, no, by Zeus, I certainly can't mention any of our contemporary orators to you. And then they go on and they talk about people like Themistocles and Miletiades and Pericles. And Socrates says, these are not good men. These were the heroes of Athens and of the previous generation of the Athenians. Pericles had just died, which places this date near the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. There are also things mentioned that would date this much later. Again, there's something weirdly out of whack with the chronology here. The dialogue seems to take place over a period of about 30 years. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Socrates says at 503c, Callicles, if the excellence you were speaking of earlier, the filling up of appetites, both of one's own and those of others, is the true kind, but this is not. And if what we were compelled to agree on in our subsequent discussion is the true kind instead, that a man should satisfy those of his appetites that, when they are filled up, make him better, and not those that make him worse, and that this is a matter of craft, I don't see how I can say that any of these men has proved to be much of a man, or such a man. And Callicles says, but if you look carefully, you'll find that they were. Socrates doesn't agree. He says, let's examine the matter calmly and see whether any of these men has proved to be like that. Well then, won't the good man, the man who speaks with regard to what's best, say whatever he says, not randomly, but with a view to something, just like the other craftsmen, each of whom keeps his own product in view, and so does not select and apply randomly what he applies, but so that he may give his product some shape. Take a look at painters, for instance, if you would, or house builders, or shipwrights, or any of the other craftsmen, if you like, and see how each one places what he does into a certain organization. The Greek word for organization here is taxis, and it comes up quite a lot. And he compels one thing to be suited for another. He adapts things together, makes them fit, and to fit until the entire object is put together in an organized and orderly way. Again, organization is taxis, and order is cosmos. The other craftsmen, too, including the ones we were mentioning just lately, the ones concerned with the body, physical trainers and doctors, no doubt give order and organization to the body. Do we agree that this is so or not? And Callicles says, let's take it that way. So if a house gets to be organized and orderly, it would be a good one. And if it gets disorganized, it would be a terrible one. I agree. Same with a boat. You know, he's going to start listing things, boats and planes and cobblers and so forth. He doesn't go on very long. But Socrates says, what about the soul? Will it be a good one if it gets to be disorganized, or if it gets to have a certain organization, taxis, and order, cosmos? He agrees. Callicles agrees with this. Morality is the health of the soul. The moral philosopher is the doctor of the soul, basically. So a little further down, between C and D, 504 C and D, Socrates says, basically, the body becomes healthy, the soul becomes excellent, it becomes virtuous. And Socrates goes on, and the name for the states of organization and order of the soul is lawful and law, which lead people to become law-abiding and orderly, and these are justice and self-control. Lawful and law are nomion and nomos. Basically, he's talking about norms, the whole dimension of norms, not just laws like legislation, but the whole normative dimension of society. And norms produce an orderly soul, and the order of the soul consists of justice, dikaiosune, and self-control, sophrosune. Do you assent to this or not? And Callicles says, let it be so. So he's mentioning two virtues here in particular. One is justice and one is self-control. Self-control because it's the opposite of what Callicles was advocating earlier. And justice because, well, he's concerned with political philosophy. But there are two senses of justice that the ancients had, that the Greeks had. Aristotle talks about this in his Nicomachean Ethics. He says there's justice in the narrow sense of doing justice, being a just person. And then there's a more comprehensive sense of justice that you could actually describe maybe as righteousness. Comprehensive justice means a well-ordered soul, which fits in with this notion of the organized soul, the orderly soul, the cosmos. The spiritual cosmos as opposed to a spiritual chaos, which would be the state of a person who's basically corrupted because they're controlled basically by their desires. That's what it boils down to. And so Socrates says that this idea of the soul, of a well-organized soul, should be the model to which skilled and good orators will look. Okay, I'm going to start reading again. So this is what skilled and good orator will look to, or that skilled and good orator, excuse me, will look to when he applies to people's souls whatever speeches he makes as well as all of his actions. Now this is interesting because now he's admitting the possibility as well that there can be good orators. In this chart, oratory is something that only falls into the category of corruption. Now, though, he's talking about the using the art of public speaking for just ends, to make people better. And this is an important thing to recognize here. It is possible for there to be a good form of oratory, a good form of rhetoric for Socrates. It has to be guided by the good, and specifically guided by an image of the well-ordered soul, the just, righteous, virtuous soul. That's the guide that allows the orators to choose their words. Okay, so this is what that skilled and good orator will look to when he applies to people's souls whatever speeches he makes, as well as all of his actions, and any gift he makes or any confiscation he carries out. He will always give his attention to how justice may come to exist in the souls of his fellow citizens and injustice be gotten rid of, how self-control may come to exist there and lack of discipline be gotten rid of, and how the rest of excellence. The word excellence there is arete, You could also translate that as virtue. The rest of virtue may come into being there, and badness may depart. Do you agree or not? And Callicles says, I do. This is an important point. So let's just take a little break here and see if there's some questions and comments. And if not, I'll just plunge ahead. Checking entropy. Okay, I'm not seeing anything new at entropy. What about you folks at Odyssey? There are 38 of you watching now. This is good. Basically, Socrates says, well, look, again, if doctoring the soul is producing virtue, and that was and that's what leads to happiness, then we should encourage self-control. Just as a doctor would prevent a person who's sick from eating foods that would exacerbate his illness, so a soul doctor would prevent a person from satisfying appetites that are spiritually corruptive. And he actually gets Callicles almost to agree to this point, which is at 505b, just above c. He says, so to be disciplined is better for the soul than lack of discipline, which is what you yourself were thinking just now. I don't know what in the world you mean, Socrates. Ask somebody else. He's been shamed here. He's been caught. His ears are turning red. And Socrates says, this fellow won't put up with being benefited and with his undergoing the very thing the discussion's about, with being disciplined. He's saying, you know, he's not willing to learn this lesson very easily. And Callicles says, and I couldn't care less about anything you say either. I gave you these answers just for Gorgias' sake, which is kind of charming. He does respect Gorgias. So let's go. Gorgias then intervenes and says, you need to keep going. But Callicles is fuming. He's angry. And so at this point, Socrates is forced to do the dialogue himself, which is kind of comical, and I'll try and do it justice. At 506c, Callicles says, speak on, my good friend, and finish it up by yourself. And Socrates says, listen then, as I pick up the discussion from the beginning, is the pleasant the same as the good? It isn't, as Callicles and I have agreed. Is the pleasant to be done for the sake of the good, or the good for the sake of the pleasant? The pleasant for the sake of the good. And pleasant is that by which, when it's come to be present in us, we feel pleasure, and good that by which, when it's present in us, we are good. That's right. But surely we are good, both we and everything that's good, when some excellence has come to be present in us, some virtue. Yes, I do think that's necessarily so. But the best way in which the excellence of each thing comes to be present in it, whether it's that of an artifact or of a body or a soul as well, or of any animal, is not just any old way, but is due to whatever organization, correctness, and craftsmanship is bestowed on each of them. Is that correct? Yes, I agree. So it's due to organization, and that that the excellence of each thing is something which is organized and has order. Yes, I'd say so. So it's when a certain order, a proper one for each thing, comes to be present in it, that it makes each of the things there are good. Yes, I think so. So also a soul which has its own order is better than a disordered one, necessarily. But surely one that has order is an orderly one. Of course it is. And an orderly soul is a self-controlled one. Absolutely. So a self-controlled soul is a good one. I, for one, can't say anything else beyond that, Callicles, my friend. If you can, please teach me. Well, Callicles says, basically says, say on, my good man. It's the equivalent of saying, yeah, yeah. You can just imagine him rolling his eyes. Whatever you say, Socrates, Socrates continues, I say that if the self-controlled soul is a good one, then a soul that's been affected the opposite way of the self-controlled one is a bad one. And this, it's turned out, is the foolish and undisciplined one. That's right. And surely a self-controlled person would do what's appropriate with respect to both gods and human beings. For if he does what's inappropriate, he wouldn't be self-controlled. That's necessarily how it is. And of course, if he did what's appropriate with respect to human beings, he would be doing what's just. And with respect to gods, he would be doing what's pious. And one who does what's just and pious must necessarily be just and pious. That's so. Yes. And he would also necessarily be brave, for it's not like a self-controlled man to either pursue or avoid what isn't appropriate, but to avoid and pursue what he should, whether these things are to do or people or pleasures or pains, and to stand fast and endure them where he should. So it's necessarily very much the case, Callicles, that the self-controlled man, because he's just and brave and pious, as we've recounted, is a completely good man, and the good man does well and admirably whatever he does, and the man who does well is blessed and happy, while the corrupt man, the man who does badly, is miserable. And this would be the man, this would be the one who's in the opposite to, in the condition opposite to that of the self-controlled one, the undisciplined one, whom you were praising. So this is how I set down the matter, and I say that it is true. And if it is true, then a person who wants to be happy must evidently pursue and practice self-control. And each of us must flee away from lack of discipline as quickly as his feet will carry him, and must, above all, make sure that he has no need of being disciplined. And if he does have that need, either he himself or anyone in his house, either a private citizen or a whole city, he must pay his due and be disciplined if he's to be happy. This is very Spartan-sounding stuff, but this, I think, should be taken entirely in earnest. I don't think Socrates is being ironic here, okay? I think he's trying to be a little shocking here, but he's not messing around. Again, he's not joking. He's a serious man. This is to be taken seriously. And then we get to something that's extremely interesting and important for later philosophy. Okay, so let's just continue reading. He must pay his due and be disciplined. This is the target which I think one should look to in living. And in his actions, he should direct all of his own affairs and those of the city to the end that justice and self-control will be present in one who is to be blessed. He should not allow his appetites to be undisciplined or undertake to fill them up. That's interminably bad, and live the life of a marauder. Such a man could not be dear to another man or to a god, for he cannot be a partner. And where there's no partnership, there's no friendship. Yes, Callicles, wise men claim that partnership and friendship, orderliness, self-control, and justice hold together heaven and earth, gods and men. And that is why they call this universe a cosmos, my friend, an order, and not an undisciplined world disorder. Now, there are two things here. First of all, years ago when I did a lecture on the Gorgias, I congratulated myself, and I still congratulate myself today, on making a point that I don't think has been made in the literature, that here, Plato in the Gorgias, Socrates in the Gorgias, is talking about something that Martin Heidegger talks about many years later as the fourfold. One of the more obscure ideas in Heidegger's later thought is the fourfold. And the fourfold, he says, is an order of things, a cosmic order, an order of the world that consists of four elements: earth and sky or heaven, and gods and mortals or men, gods and men, heaven and earth, gods and men. This is the Heideggerian fourfold. And I think Heidegger might be thinking about what's going on here. So he says, Callicles, wise men claim that partnership and friendship, orderliness, self-control, and justice hold together heaven and earth, and gods and men. So this is a cosmic principle now. It's not just something that exists within the soul of the individual man. There's a cosmic order here. And that is why we call this universe a world order, my friend, and not an undisciplined world disorder. I believe that you don't pay attention to these facts, even though you're a wise man in these matters. You fail to notice that proportionate equality has great power among both gods and men, and you suppose that you ought to practice getting the greater share. That's because you neglect geometry. Now, what's he talking about here? I think he's talking about something that's taken up by Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics, where he talks about distributive justice. Aristotle in the Ethics says that there are two kinds of justice, distributive justice and retributive justice. Retributive justice is about punishment. It's what Socrates would describe as, you know, the process of restoring the health of the soul. What's distributive justice? Well, that has to do with awarding prizes, basically, awarding goods, honors, physical things, and so forth. And Aristotle says that since men are unequal, they shouldn't get equal shares. Unequal men getting equal shares is injustice. If some men are more virtuous than others, if some men are harder working than others, they should have more. How much more? Well, it has to be proportionate to the difference between themselves and others. So if you are twice as virtuous as your neighbor, if you've done twice as much for the city, say, you should be getting twice as much honor. That's just. If you get 10 times as much honor, that's unjust. So Aristotle says that inequality has to be proportionate to merit. It's unjust to treat equal people equally, it's unjust to treat unequal people equally, but it's also unjust to treat unequal people disproportionately unequally, right? So therefore, there has to be proportionality in inequality. The rewards that are meted out to unequal people have to be proportionate to their virtue, to their actual being. And therefore, it's possible for some people to excel, some people to get a lot, some people to get more, but there's a kind of geometry here. There's a kind of order here that means that it's unjust to just keep grabbing off more and more and more. You might deserve a greater share, Callicles, but you don't deserve it all. And there might be too much. Okay, so I think that's very interesting. This is very rich when you look at it in light of subsequent philosophy. This idea of a world harmony, a cosmos, which is a balancing of heaven and earth, gods and men. There's an internal order of the soul that we have to strive for. And within society, there is a geometric inequality, a proportionate inequality that we have to strive for in the distribution of goods and honors. Now, at this point, there is a segue into another discussion. Okay, ABC is written in with $10. Thank you. It looks like Plato is suitable for a presentation following Spinoza's geometrical method. We can start with a set of generally accepted self-evident truths and deduce everything else based on pure logic. So why did Nietzsche not like Plato or the geometrical method? As far as I know, too rigid? The trouble, you can't really cast... Okay. It's an interesting question. What's Socrates' method? What's Plato's method? Well, it's not geometric. Because what they're trying to do is move towards the first principles. It's not deductive. Okay. I mean, there are certain deductive arguments, the argument that pleasure is not the good because, well, there are good and bad pleasures. That's a deductive argument. That's modus tollens. It's a completely valid deductive argument. But if you were to cast it all in terms of deductive arguments, you'd have to define the first principles. You'd have to lay it all out. And Plato doesn't get there. Plato doesn't get to the first principles in words, okay? And so you can't really recast it that way. Plato is assuming, though, that we know what the good is. All of his arguments assume that we've got some kind of intuitive but inarticulate understanding of the good. So, for instance, if you venture that the good life is a life of pleasure, and somebody points out, well, there are bad pleasures and good pains, we know at that point that pleasure is not an adequate account of the good. Does that mean we know what the good is? Well, yes and no. We don't have an articulated account of it. That's what we're trying to get. But we already know enough about it, inarticulately, if you will, to recognize when a proposed definition of the good isn't up to snuff. So what does that mean? Well, does it mean that we'll never get to articulated first principles that we can then put out in a geometric form and have a purely deductive philosophy? It might mean that, but it also might mean that we don't need that. It might be the case that the ultimate principles in ethics are like the ultimate principles in aesthetics. They're not things that we can fully articulate, and they're not things that we need to fully articulate. It might be the case that good people are people who simply have very refined moral perception, and so they can see what's good and bad in particular circumstances without any general rules, and therefore without the ability to create any kind of deductive argument. So that's a really interesting, deep question, though, about philosophical method. There's no possibility with Plato as he exists in this dialogue or in the existing Platonic corpus, though, to reconstruct it all as a deductive system because the first principles have not been articulated exhaustively in words. And I would argue that they don't even need to be, that maybe that's a kind of category error. Socrates is always using what's called the Socratic fallacy. I don't think that Socrates fell for this fallacy or Plato. It's the fallacy that if you can't define something, you don't really know it. Socrates uses that as a tool to humiliate know-it-alls who think that they know what piety is, in the case of Euthyphro, for instance. And he says, well, define piety for me, Euthyphro. What is it? And Euthyphro can't give a definition. And then Socrates says, well, you know, Euthyphro, if you can't define piety, maybe you should just go along with the flow and accept the conventional views of piety that reign in our society rather than becoming a nuisance and a crank. That's the kind of thing that Socrates does. I don't think Socrates believes that we need to be able to articulate things to know them. And he tells this fanciful story about how in a previous existence, we've all glimpsed the forms. And so we have a knowledge of the forms, which basically are the ultimate principles of things. We've seen them. And then we forget what we know. And the process of philosophical dialectic is recollecting what we've forgotten. So he's telling a myth about how we know what the good is. We know what piety is. We know all these important concepts already, but we don't know them self-consciously and articulately. And it's this inarticulate knowledge that we've got, this implicit knowledge that we've got that we're unfolding. in philosophical dialectic. And that's what guides the whole process. We already know the answer, and we're using that knowledge to try and articulate what we already know. But we may never exhaustively articulate it, and we might not need to. Okay, so let's move forward. Okay, so Socrates has laid out some deep stuff here about the order of the soul, the order of the world, and the justice that reigns in society, which should be proportionate equality. He's laid out a very powerful case to Callicles that he should practice self-control, that he needs to rein in his endless desire, and that that's the path to happiness. And then he challenges Callicles to refute the argument. And then he changes the subject and he says, so let's talk about what you've been taking me to task for and whether it's right or not. This is 508C. Let's examine what it is you're taking me to task for and whether it's right or not. You say that I'm unable to protect either myself or my friends or relatives or rescue them from the gravest dangers, and that I'm at the mercy of the first comer, just as people without rights are, whether he wants to knock me on the jaw, to use that forceful expression of yours, to confiscate my property, to exile me from the city, or ultimately put me to death. To be in that position is, by your reasoning, the most shameful thing of all. As for what my own reasoning is, that's been told many times by now, but there's nothing to stop it from being told once again. I deny, Callicles, that being knocked on the jaw unjustly is the most shameful thing, or that having my body or purse cut is. And I affirm that to knock or cut me or my possessions unjustly is both shameful and worse, and that at the same time that to rob or enslave me or to break into my house or to sum up to commit any unjust act at all against me and my possessions is both worse and more shameful for the one who does these unjust acts than it is for me, the one who suffers them. Okay, we've heard this all before. He's summarizing this. These conclusions at which we arrived earlier in our previous discussion are, I'd say, held down and bound by arguments of iron and adamant, even if it's rather rude to say so. This is a very strong knowledge claim. There are many people who go around saying Socrates claimed not to know anything, hearty, har, har, har. If you read the Platonic dialogue, Socrates makes all kinds of very strong knowledge claims. He's making a very strong knowledge claim here that his position that it is better to suffer injustice than to do it, better for one's soul, is bound down by arguments of iron and adamant. Even though it's rude to say so, what's he saying there? He says, well, he's making a nod to Greek conventional moral sympathies, which is that it's a bit show-offy to say things like that. Gorgias has been quite arrogant early on. Recall, he's saying, I've never heard a question that I couldn't answer. I've heard these all before, and I'm a wonderful guy, right? I'm the best. I'm the best in my field. He's willing to do that because he's around peers. If he were around people that he thought were inferiors, he'd have to tone it down a bit and be ironic, be a little bit self-deprecating, basically. And Socrates is sort of making a nod in that same direction, too. He's saying, look, it's sort of rude to say things like this. It sounds like bragging, but I'm among peers here, and I can say it. These arguments are bound by iron and adamant. You know, this is unbeatable, and he challenges anyone to try it. Then he continues, so it would seem anyhow, which is interesting. So it would seem, this is absolutely certain, so it would seem. And if you or someone more forceful than you won't undo them, then anyone who says anything other than what I'm now saying cannot be speaking well. And yet for my part, my account is ever the same. I don't know how these things are, but no one I've ever met, as in this case, can say anything else without being ridiculous. So this is interesting. They're bound by arguments of iron and adamant, or so it seems. I haven't heard any better arguments. And he says, my account is ever the same. I don't know how these things are. Okay, that's a non-knowledge claim. But no one I've ever met, as in this case, can say anything else without being ridiculous. So you can see how Socrates has this reputation for claiming not to know. But it's pretty powerful knowledge claim anyway, because he's saying, look, I'm not going to be dogmatic. I'm not going to claim that there's no possible better argument here, but I've never heard one. And until I hear one, I'm not budging on this. And then he he makes an argument here that I think is important. He says, 509C, he says, the greater by nature each bad thing is, the more admirable it is to be able to provide protection against it too, and the more shameful not to be able to. Is this the way it is, Callicles, or is it some other way? What's he saying here? He's saying the worse something is, the more admirable it is to have some kind of protection against it, and the more shameful it is to neglect that protection. And Callicles agrees with that. And so which of these two things then, doing what's unjust or suffering injustice? Okay, so of these two things then, of doing what's unjust and suffering it, we say that doing it is worse and suffering it is less bad. And then he says, okay, if doing injustice is worse, then it's more honorable to have protection against doing it than it is to have protection against suffering it, right? If doing injustice is worse than suffering injustice, then it's more important and more honorable to protect yourself from doing it than suffering it. Okay, makes sense. And then he asks, with what then might a man provide himself to protect himself so that he has both these benefits, the one that comes from not doing what's unjust and the one that comes from not suffering it? Is it power or wish? What I mean is this. Is it when a person doesn't wish to suffer what's unjust that he will avoid suffering it? Or when he procures a power to avoid suffering it? And he says, well, Callicles says, when he procures a power, that's obvious at least. Okay, you can't prevent yourself from suffering injustice just by wishing it. You've got to harden yourself against it. You have to have a power against it. And then Socrates says, and what about doing what's unjust? Is it when he doesn't wish to do it? Is that sufficient? For he won't do it. Or should he procure a power or craft for this too, so that unless he learns and practices it, he will commit injustice? Why don't you answer at least this question, Callicles? Obviously, Callicles, there's a pause here. He sees Callicles' face, some expression on his face, and says, why don't you answer this, Callicles? Do you think Polus and I were or were not correct in being compelled to agree in our previous discussion when we agreed that no one does what's unjust because he wants to, but that all who do so do it unwillingly? So that's where we're going to end today. We're getting to a very, very important question, though, which we'll discuss in our last session, which is, do people do bad things voluntarily? Or do they do them involuntarily? Now, by involuntary, I don't mean through some kind of twitch or something, some kind of nervous tick, right? You're holding a rock and you have a muscle spasm and hurl the rock through a window and say, it was involuntary. I'm not talking about that. Basically, what Socrates is talking about ultimately is that people only do bad things out of ignorance. And therefore, they don't really want to do bad things. It's not chosen. It happens involuntarily because they mistake bad things for the good. Okay, so we'll get into all of this next time, but it's very rich. But it's very, very important here. Callicles takes Socrates to task for not being able to protect himself from injustice. And it's true, Socrates is not really capable of protecting himself from injustice. Or is he? Socrates makes a big show of disdain for the rhetoric of the law courts. Socrates is dragged into court near the end of his life, and he's found guilty and punished by death. And so you could say, well, apparently Socrates wasn't any good at rhetoric. If you read my chapter in the Trial of Socrates on Plato's Apology of Socrates, Socrates' defense speech, where I analyze Plato's presentation of Socrates' speech, I show that Socrates is actually an extremely clever rhetorician. He knew oratory inside and out. He is not naive in this area. He is not a bumbler. The reason why he didn't win, though, is, well, there are multiple reasons. ultimately, because it's impossible for philosophy to justify itself as philosophy to the public. And the Apology of Socrates shows that, but it also shows that Socrates is a brilliant rhetorician. Socrates ended up dying because he chose the life of philosophy, and philosophy can't defend itself to the public. It wasn't because Socrates was bad at rhetoric, and that a suaver Socrates could have gotten off basically by somehow harmonizing philosophy and politics. This just can't be done, okay? Socrates knew the art of rhetoric, and he's already intimated here that there can be good orators who look to the good, whose model is the soul of the people they're speaking to, the health of the soul. They're trying to produce health in the souls of the people they address, and they're also trying to produce justice, that geometric proportional inequality that he talks about in the city as a whole. And they even look to the model of the cosmos. They have a sense of where man fits into the big picture. These images, which are sort of nested inside one another, you've got the big cosmic fourfold. You've got the city and its proper order, and you've got the individuals in the city and the proper ordering of their souls. These levels of order that the philosopher accesses can be the models that the rhetorician, the proper rhetorician, the good orator uses in choosing his words and making people better, to the extent that that's possible. Socrates knows this and knows how to do it. Is he incapable of defending himself? Well, in the end, he's incapable of defending philosophy in a public way. That's his incapacity, but it's an incapacity that's built in to philosophy and the city and their relationship. It's not a failing on the part of Socrates. That's what I want to argue. Socrates knows the art of rhetoric, and Gorgias is just wrong. But Gorgias is right that Socrates will be helpless, but he's just right. He's right for the wrong reasons. He doesn't understand. It's not through lack of art that Socrates was convicted. It's through something else. It's through a deep disharmony between the interests of philosophy and the interests of political life. Okay, so it's this conflict between the life of politics and the life of philosophy that they're talking about here. that led to Socrates' downfall. So Callicles, again, is criticizing Socrates for not being able to protect himself without understanding the truth of the matter. Socrates knows the art of rhetoric, and he knows that there can be a good form of rhetoric. It's just that that good form of rhetoric, of which he is a master, cannot prevail when he's put on trial at the end of his life. And so he says, well, you say I'm helpless. Well, let's talk about the two things that we would like to avoid here, doing injustice and suffering injustice. The greater evil is doing injustice. And I can prevent myself from doing evil far easier than I can prevent myself from suffering evil. He's bringing us up to a confrontation of something that the Stoics understood. It's the first principle in Epictetus. There are some things that we can control and other things that we can't. We can control our inner states. We can control our basic decisions, our priorities, what we put first. We can control our thoughts, but we cannot control circumstances. It takes power to control circumstances. It would take a great deal of power to make Socrates invulnerable to injustice. It takes a great deal of power to make any of us invulnerable to injustice. None of us are invulnerable to injustice. Elon Musk could be taken down with all of his billions unjustly. None of us is immune to injustice. And one of the questions that we see later on in the last part of the dialogue is the absurd lengths that we would have to go to in the pursuit of immunity to injustice. It's out of our control. We can take certain precautions, but ultimately it's out of our control. What we can control, though, is what we do within our own sphere, namely our own choices, our own internal hierarchy of values, our own spiritual order. And we can simply, by wishing not to do injustice, protect ourselves from doing injustice. We can simply wish it away. So he's basically laying a challenge out to Callicles. Which thing is more important to prove yourself against or proof yourself against, doing injustice or suffering it? He says, obviously, it's doing injustice that we should try and prevent. And we can do that very easily with just a wish, where it becomes very difficult, as we will see, to make ourselves immune from suffering injustice. So anyway, that's what I want to cover, and we'll do the rest of the dialogue next time and wrap this up. So let's see if there are any questions or comments. And if there are none more, we'll just wrap up. Friedrich writes in with $10. Thank you. Hello. At present, too many of our people are adamant that the welfare of minorities in our countries at the expense of our own welfare is the ultimate good. How would you approach making a reasonable person holding such a conviction to at least question, if not change it? Thank you. Well, that's a huge question. Ultimately, it boils down to the question of whether it's moral to give priority to one's own people first. And I think that on an instinctive level, most people actually would agree with that. But when it comes to this stuff about, you know, refugees and minorities and people like that, these sanctified totemic others, the more exotic they are, somehow the more exciting they are morally to people. This is what's called xenophilia. How do you break this down? Well, there are a number of things you can do. One is you can just heighten people's awareness of the suffering of their own people. The fact is that every country has people who are suffering, people who are in need, who are part of the founding population, the majority, the body politic. They're not outsiders. And yet they suffer. And you see people in Britain who are homeless, Britons who are homeless and foreign refugee parasites who show up in rubber rafts being put up in comfortable hotels at public expense. How is this right? You have to confront them with moral obscenities like this. And you have to get it down and you got to get it dirty and rub their faces in it and make it personal. Most of these people would never say that they would be more virtuous to help out the neighbor's child than their own child. A lady I knew, a philosophy professor I knew years ago, had this argument, and I thought it was just wonderful. This is a great example. What kind of father would say this? He'd say, "Johnny, I've been saving money for your college education, but you know, the kid next door, he's poorer than us, and his grades are actually better. And so I've decided that it would be more virtuous for me to help the needy neighbor go to college than you, my son." Reflect on this. If your father tried that on you, you would have to conclude that your father is a monster. He's a monster of moral vanity. He's engaged in some kind of moral grandstanding, and he's violating his parental duties to you. And where there should be natural parental affection and a sense of priority, there's just this narcissism and this cold, calculating narcissism and desire to virtue signal one's xenophilia, one's altruism. Most people aren't that evil. And most people recognize that somebody like that is evil and phony. They would recognize it when it would come to harming their own child to help some other child. But they don't recognize it when it's more abstract, when it's just, you know, some stranger who might be part of their own ethnic group. But, you know, this person is some sort of loser. I'm sick of these losers. And then they go to the rush to the train station with their refugees welcome sign. There's something morally heinous about that. There's some moral disorder there. And it's actually unnatural. Now, maybe these people are unnatural. We know that liberals are wired in such a way that they have low in-group preference. They're sick puppies, basically. And maybe it's good that they are slowly not breeding themselves out of the gene pool. Maybe it's good that people who have such poor instincts also have, low fertility. Maybe the next generation will have fewer of these sick people in it, these sick xenophiles. The only hope that we have is that these people in positions of power don't completely wreck everything before they can be shuffled out of power through just sort of natural biological processes. They'll get old and die. We hope that they die before they destroy civilization. But I think it is possible, though, to try and confront people who aren't sick, but who have just sort of passively accepted these sick values to see that, no, there's something unnatural about it. It's natural, normal, and right to feel more comfortable around people who are genetically similar to you. Most comfortable amongst your own kith and kin, it's natural, normal, and right for you to have preferences for your own family and for your extended family, for your ethnic group, for the people who share your culture and sense of life and language and so forth. That's all natural, normal, and right. And there's something sick about not having these preferences. Most people can be brought around to seeing that, and the people who don't see it because they're not wired that way, we need to prize their hands off the levers of power and make sure that their kind doesn't influence the future with their sick values. So good question. Thank you. Let's see if there are other questions here. Whites sell out their kind because they've been given this fake moral code to do so. That wraps it up. We've been doing this for almost 2 hours, so I think it's good to break here. We've run out of questions and we've run out of Play-Doh.